and welcome to Writing About Dragons and Shit, a podcast where two authors and a writer get together and talk about the ways they tell stories. I'm one of your hosts, Trevor Bettis, writer of Isle Champions of the Forgotten Realms and host of way too many podcasts. And with me each week are two amazing people who are...
I'm Erin M. Evans. I write fantasy novels. I'm best known for the Books of the Usurper and the Brynston Angels saga.
It is I, B. Dave Walters. I have returned from the lands of my ancestors. home of the colonizers, where they spread out all over the entire world to bring back spices and then not use them.
It's one of the great ironies, isn't it?
Yeah. And don't feel bad. I said this to their faces in their eateries, and they had. I'm 1 foot into the next world with jet lag, but I could not miss this this wonderful conversation here. So glad to be back.
And also joining us this week is
Bethany Jacobs. Hi, everybody. I am the recent debut author of a novel called These Burning Stars, out with Orbit. It's the first book in a trilogy called the Kingdom Trilogy. I'm really delighted to be here and talk about writing in all of its agonies and pleasures.
That is a great description of just talking about writing in general.
Indeed, you just sit down at the typewriter and bleed. Yep.
I'm feeling that a lot this week, I'm not going to lie.
Thank you for joining us, Bethany. And you suggested talking about sequels, which I don't think we've ever done like an episode on that. We've talked about them briefly here and there, but that is something that definitely deserves a full episode.
Saving something for the sequel. We've said that. Yeah.
So I guess here's the thing. I don't have experience with this. I've written so many first novels and gone, no. So I've never gotten to that point. Like I've gotten to the point of like thinking about what a sequel would be for a book and whatnot. So I want to ask the folks who have, what is it like writing a sequel?
I'd say let's let the guest start it up.
So, you know, it's funny, when I wrote the first book, I wrote it as a standalone with the understanding that it could be a sequel or it could be a trilogy if it wanted to be. And then when I got my book deal, they were like, what else do you have? Can this be a trilogy? And I was like, okay, yeah, let's do that. The ideas for what would happen next weren't yet formed when I got my book deal. And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, now write the sequel. And the thing that, obviously the pleasure of writing a sequel, particularly in genre fiction where world building is so important and rich, is that in a sequel, you get to go bigger, right? Yeah. You get to, there's more culture, there's more places, there's more people. You get to take things that were maybe really tiny in the first book and say, now we're going to blow that up. And that can be really fun. And it's also fun to take these characters who if you did your job right, had some kind of arc in the first book and say, okay, so how are they leveling up? Like, what's their arc in the second book? How am I going to move their development and turn them into somebody new? And all of that is hugely pleasurable as a writer. The challenge that I face, and Erin, I think you're going to say the same thing, is that all of a sudden, when you had all of this time to write the first one and there wasn't any deadline on the first one, suddenly you have this deadline for the second one. Like my first novel, I wrote over a period of 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, okay, give us the sequel in 9 months.
Speed run time.
Yes. Right. And so that is the logistical challenge. Is that you just don't have as much time to write it. And so there's this ingrained anxiety that it can't possibly be as polished and good as the first one because you just don't have as much time. Mm-hmm. And then the sort of existential dread of the second one is...
I think that should be the name of the episode. It's like episode whatever, sequels, parentheses, existential dread. Yes.
the existential dread of the second one. You knew all of it, I think.
Exactly. I mean, and I think what that existential dread is that, you know, you wrote a first book that people loved enough to polish. Mm-hmm. What if the second book sucks? Like, I think they bought it sight unseen and are assuming that you can create success a second time. But what if they're wrong?
What if you can't model that lightning?
What you do is terrible.
So, I wonder if you have the same experience. I wrote Relics of Ruin. So I've written book two in two series. And I thought, just as a like quick overview, the first time I wrote a second book in a series was Brimstone Angels, Lesser Evils. And I wrote that book while I was pregnant and then like the sort of fourth trimester. So I didn't remember most of writing it. It was incredibly hard.
Can we talk about that?
I have
We talk about not remembering writing the book?
It's a weird thing, right? It's weird.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like I find the experience of going back, especially when you go back over like past pages and you're like, they changed this. Like, oh my God, Relics had this line. And I was like, that's terrible. Like, why are you changing the dialogue? And I was getting really worked up. And then I was like, before you leave a note, go back and look at what you sent them before. And I went back and I was like, oh, I changed that line. I made that bad dialogue choice. That was me. They were it's catching so my thing. Because you just get this weird, like, it's out. But so that was an awful experience. I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. I was stressed. It didn't go well. And I thought that's why it was bad. And then I wrote another book too. And I'm like, oh, it's still hard.
I mean, Stephen King doesn't remember writing Cujo, but for him, it was cocaine. For you, it was
Cujo. I have literally referred to Lesser Evils as my Cujo, but less exciting, right? Because it was a baby, not cocaine.
Yeah.
Well, I think that like when you write fast, like you hear about those people who they're like, oh, I wrote the rough draft of my book in like a month, you know, and I'm like, who are you? Like, what species are you? How can you possibly remember
by a radioactive typewriter and do you still have it?
Yeah.
And B-Dave is like, that's me.
Yeah, that's
B-Dave. I'm that person.
That's to you, but like, I don't understand how it's possible. Oh, like, yeah. I just, you know, but yeah, I do think that like there is this strange experience when you, for me, of this is my first published novel. I've written sequels before, but never under a deadline. And it's enough to cure you of the desire to want to write a series ever again. Like, I've been thinking in the past year, like standalones for the rest of my career, like that's it.
I will say that experience you're having, though, that like that's common of so many creative types. That's why so many people have one good album or one good novel or one good screenplay, because you have forever. You have forever. There's no pressure. You can polish it. You can make it exactly what you want and exactly the way you want to do it. And then, yes, they come back and they're like, hey, you know, that thing that was your opus, do it again in half the time. Every single. So, by no means weird.
And everybody in the writing community has talked about this same phenomenon that I've spoken to, who has said, you know, writing the sequel is one of the most grueling things that you'll do as a debut author. And so, the fear of writing something, you know, that ends up being terrible is quite strong in me. But I'm trying to lean on my knowledge of the fact that I've been writing since I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been honing the craft of storytelling for like 30 years.
Yeah.
I'm not an amateur.
So, I think the other part, I don't know if you, I think you had the same experience here where they're like, the book has not come out yet. People have not read it yet, but you need to write a sequel that is going to please the audience that you don't yet know if they like the thing. And by the time you know, you're like, I cannot look at that. I cannot worry about that because we're too far in. Either you love this or we don't, but we'll just find out.
Well, and then the other thing, which I wonder if you experienced this, Erin, while writing this, your sequel, that I forgot what happens in the first one.
Oh yeah,
like, I had to
reread it.
I had this question here, and so I was like, "How do you go about doing that? Like, do you just kind of you have to go back and check it, or do you have like a synopsis of the previous one?" Or
I go back and I reread it. Yeah. Or the audiobook is a nice thing. If you, I could not listen to my audiobooks for years because they made me weirdly embarrassed. Like I don't know why. Someone reading it out loud was just threw me back to like baby writer, like, oh no, nobody can look at my notebooks kind of feeling. But I've gotten over it, which makes it a lot faster because they can just listen to it at high speed because I know the book and just get that sort of reminder. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, so what happened with me was I wrote the sequel between like April and January 1st of last year, 2022. And then it sat with my editor for 9 months. And then my editor,
we get stuff from them. It's, can you turn this around in 3 days? And I just said to them, they're like, I'll get to this as soon as possible. 9 months later.
Yeah. So then my editor left.
I was
quite lucky because my current editor, my first editor was amazing too. My current editor, Tiana Coven, had worked on the first one. She's fantastic.
She was my editor's assistant for Relics.
She was my editor's assistant for the sequel or for the first one. And then my editor left, it was like, let's give this to Tiana. She's great. She had amazing notes for me. But now, 9 months later, I'm in this position of, okay, like, I don't remember the fever dream of writing this sequel. I haven't read the first one, like, other than past pages in a year. So I did listen to the audiobook. I'm grateful because one of my favorite narrators, Natalie Nottis, is the narrator of the audiobook.
Oh, nice.
But it's still like a super weird experience. Like, and it's this kind of out of body experience because then you're like seeing their interpretation of the book and like comparing it against your interpretation of the book. So I've relied on rereading it via audiobook. I frequently go back to the first one and reread sections and chapters and use it as like a reference guide. And then I have like exhaustive world building materials and plot lines and character graphs and everything that that I couldn't do it without. Like, I don't have the memory that I used to.
Yeah.
You know, like I have this incredibly dense, and it sounds like you guys' work too has the same thing with world building where it's incredibly dense. And I don't have the skills anymore to just remember
everything. You're not building the wiki page that people will, you know, for some novels and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So
the closest that I, because you're all talking about like not remembering the stuff that you wrote, the closest that I have to this is with game writing is sometimes I have to like, you know, someone will be like, hey, we need this flavor text for feats written today. And so I bang out like, you know, 15 feet flavor text. And it got to the point that like, I was playing the game a few weeks ago and I put a piece of equipment on, I read the flavor text, went, oh, that's really funny. I hope I wrote that. I genuinely could not remember if I wrote it or not.
yeah. It's like sometimes when, especially when you're working fast, you know, like you enter another dimension and then it's like, and then you leave that dimension and re-enter the real world and there's like this disconnect and you're not the same people.
Mm-hmm. I will say the nice thing. Well, this, I guess, is the nice thing about doing IP work and having that fan base is that when I was writing Brimstone Angels, which is a 6-book series, right? Uh-huh. So around book 4, I realized I did not, I just told the story recently, so sorry if you're hearing it as a repeat. that around book 4, I needed to know this character's eye color and I didn't remember it. And I wasn't sure if I had actually said it. Mm. And you can't really like search 400,000 words for like...
Yeah.
Variations on brown. So I just like crowdsourced it. I was like, hey fans, can you please find this for me? I think I determined that nobody could find any instances of it. So he doesn't get his eye color established until book 4. But
sometimes
that's nice once you have enough readers to do the work for you.
Oh yeah. 100%. Yeah. I've made the mistake where like I have a description of a character in one section and then like 100 pages later their eye color has changed. And then I realize it very late in the game and I'm like, oh shit, their eye color has changed and I have to fix that. I had this moment where I was recently rereading the first chapter where I got so pissed because there's a character who has a very distinctive coat. It's like mm-hmm. a signifier of her office in the religion that she works for. And the coat comes to the knees, but in a much earlier version of the book, it went to the ankles. And I'm reading the first chapter of my book and it describes the coat like swishing around her ankles. And I was just like,
those ghosts of previous drafts.
This is where we point out again that the reason why The Hobbit exists is Christopher Tolkien was a pedantic asshole. And J.R.R. Tolkien would tell stories, and he's like, last time you said the door was blue, Papa. And he's like, started writing it down. Like, God damn it. The door is blue. Yeah. So there you go.
It's true.
Yeah. I do always love picturing J.R.R. Tolkien just being like, all right, fine, you little shit. Okay. It's a exactly. Green door. Yeah.
Green. Yep.
So one of the things that I did want to ask is because we've talked about standalone novels with series potential, and then there are ones times where it's just like, no, this is going to be a series and stuff like that. Is there a big difference between those sort of sequels? Because like one of them, you know, I feel like the standalone with series potential, like that one has a more firm ending probably than the one that is a series does. And so is writing a sequel to those different than if it is just straight up like, oh, this is a series that we know is going to continue?
I would be remiss if I didn't point in here that you should write the first one where it can stand alone no matter what.
Mm-hmm. I was just about to say that.
Yes, then please continue. They've heard this rant from me, but not from you. Please, go on.
Right. I mean, so the first thing I was going to say is that my choice to write it as a standalone was very much a strategic decision. Mm-hmm. Right. It was like, you know, I'm on the market. I'm trying to sell my first book. If I try to sell a book that clearly has, you know, an open ending that's inviting a series, that could shut doors for me.
Yeah.
Because I have no reason to believe that they'll want to buy a series. They may just want to buy a standalone. But I did finish the book. The book did have an ending that indicated that there could be more. Mm-hmm. It had a very like, this is done, this is clean, it's over, but there's things that open up that could happen. And so, I think that is particularly for new writers who are trying to get their first book, I would say, please don't try to write a series.
Yeah.
The book that you're trying to shop, don't write a duology even, like write a standalone novel. And if you have a vision for it to be longer, like that vision exists, but you don't know that will actually work out. And that's okay. Like there's so many stories you can write. Like it's okay if you never get to write the trilogy version of this book, like you'll get over it.
There are so many ideas in you.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's like I had someone recently, because when I started writing this book, I started writing it because I was writing a book that was going really badly.
Mm. And good, somebody, cheap book.
Yes. and somebody recently asked me, they were like, so is there any hope that we'll see that book that you set aside? And I was like, no.
Oh, yeah.
It's dead and buried. Like it was important for me as a writer. Like it taught me things. And at the time I loved it deeply and had like a very passionate dream that it would be published, but you move on and you keep writing. And it's like, you know what, there's something around the corner that's going to be even better. So why would I be like stuck on this old thing when I can move on and just continue to grow in my storytelling?
Yeah. I had someone recently during Extra Life charity thing that was just like, hey, if we donate this much, Trevor, will you put out that novel that you are never going to put out? I'm like, no, stop. I know it's for charity and I want to say yes, because that's what I do with charities, but dang it.
Or do.
I know.
Or do put it out.
Maybe next year for Extra Life, I'll put it at extremely high bar for that one. It's like, hey, you if you donate this much, you can have my embarrassment.
Oh, I know. Like I think everybody who has supportive family teases them about how their like old work and letters will someday be in a library somewhere.
No, thank you.
And that's the most mortifying thing I can imagine, is that like these books that that I wrote throughout my life would actually see the light of day. And it's just like, no, just move on to something new. But then of course the challenge is that then you like, you know, right now I'm in the middle of revising book two and my next series is like on my brain and I still have to write the third one. And I'm like fantasizing about this duology that I've imagined. I'm just like, all I want to do is write this duology. It's going to be so good. And it'll probably be over a year before I'm even in a position to say to my publisher, hey, you've got that like right of first refusal clause. Are you interested in this book? And who knows what they'll say. Mm-hmm. And so that's also something that is interesting about like the life of a writer and thinking about what's next, whether it's a sequel or like the next project. I think it's very much on every creative's mind.
Mm-hmm. I have to write the third book. I also have to write, I also owe another book to the licensor. And all I want to do is work on the two that I think would be good options.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
yeah. I know. But interestingly, I am imagining. Interestingly, though, when we talk about like make sure your first book is a standalone, I am much more imagining this future project as a duology.
Yeah.
But in thinking about that, I'm also maintaining my rule, which is that I want it to be standalone.
Yeah.
If it can be. And then if they want more, then I'd already have an idea of what the sequel will be.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, your frustration there made me think of a meme I saw yesterday that said, terrible news. Turns out vibing with your writing thoughts doesn't make it instantly appear in a Word document.
I saw that. I'm like, that's not me, but I know that feeling.
Yeah.
Or like I have four Scrivener tabs open and I have to keep going to the one that I want to open the list.
I feel like Scrivener is just constantly open and it could be any document at any moment. Like, it's like, is this going to be a D&D one? Is this going to be video games? Is this going to be my book?
See, I have not climbed onto the Scrivener train yet. I'm still like using fucking Excel and Word document. Right.
I think if you still love Word, don't leave Word, because everybody.
That's my thing is I'm right, like, I don't want to learn an entirely new system. Like this has been working for me for 30 years.
That's
like,
fine.
I
have
Google
the
Docs. Yep.
The reason I switched to Scrivener was that I have a tendency to write multiple point of view and then get into it and realize that the scenes need to go in a different order. And more than once I turned over a draft where I had repeated a scene because I forgot to delete it or accidentally deleted a scene. And so Scrivener lets me keep them as like separate documents and shift them around. So I don't make that stupid mistake.
Yeah. My reason was I'm terrible with document organization. I would be like, I know I wrote about this what file did I put that in?
You turn over the draft, right? It has to turn into a Word document to go to the editor, and then they send back notes on a Word document. So now you're working in Word and you have to switch your brain over.
Oh, no.
Or
I didn't think about that.
You have to merge it all back and make a new Scrivener document, which can be kind of a nightmare. It's fine, I think, for dev edits, like when they're like big things, because then you're just going to go through and work the document, but anything where you need to respond to comments, it is so annoying. So I would say don't leave the Word ecosystem unless you're like, this is getting in the way of me creating. It's a jumping back and forth is annoying.
That's 100%.
So one of the things that I wanted to bring up that I think got mentioned briefly at the beginning was character development through sequels. How is that handled? Like, is it something that's like, I'm picking up, I'm leaving these threads here in the first one that I can use for character development in the second one, or is it a brand new thing that is showing up for a sequel that they're developing?
Yeah. So one of my pet peeves in any series, whether it's written or a television series or whatever, is when a character has any kind of growth or development or arc in the first entry, and then that development disappears.
Oh, God. Right? It feels like a video game where it's just like, oh, it's the second one. We've removed all your powers so that you got the first
one. Exactly. It's just like, what was the point of what happened? Like, you know, and so in my first book, I have this character. She's the book has three protagonists, but she is in some ways the uber protagonist. And she spends a good portion of the book being quite passive, and things are happening to her. And she, part of her culmination is that she then like takes an active role in her fate and what's happening, and becomes more aggressive in deciding what she wants to happen in the, you know, political machinations that are going on. And as I was writing the second book, I was noticing that although she was a more radicalized character than she'd been in the first one, there was again this dynamic where people were acting on her, and she was sort of passively responding to things that were happening around her. And I realized that, like, that's not who she is anymore. Like, people might try to do that to her because that's who she was for so long, but I need this second book to show that she is not going back in time, that she is going to actually be the master of her fate. And so, you know, in her case, the arc of the second season is much less about whether or not she will, you know, be an active participant in her fate. And it's much more about how far into the darkness is she willing to go to exercise her activeness. And I think that, you know, that's the only way you make characters continue to be interesting in a sequel or a series. I recently watched Wheel of Time. Have any of you guys watched Wheel of Time?
I watched the first season. I've been dragging on the second one.
Okay. So there's a character in the first season. I don't know if any of you guys have read the books, but there's a character named Nynaeve, and she's quite angry, and she distrusts the power system and things like that. And in the second season, she's somehow even more ornery and distrustful.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like she somehow becomes even less active, and even more intransigent. And it was infuriating to me as a watcher, because I was like, okay, I can buy that in the first season because she's been introduced to this new world, and like, that's a culture shock, and people being suspicious of things they don't understand, that makes sense. But to then jump into the second season after she's experienced so much and have her just kind of be flatlined, it just drove me up the wall. I lost all respect for her character, which was a bummer because I really love the actress and I really want to love the character, but it like stopped me from being able to do that. And so I'm always thinking about that in my characters of like, are they flatlining or are they going somewhere new?
I did have a similar experience with Doctor Who, that the 11th Doctor's arc, the whole point was he forgave himself. Yeah. That, you know, it wasn't his fault that something happened to Gallifrey. Like, he really could kind of let go of all of these things. And then the 12th Doctor is a grumpier asshole. You know, it was like, wait, what?
It's wait a second.
But it's Peter Capaldi.
I get the behind the scenes.
How could he be anything else?
I know.
I get all the meta point.
Yeah.
Your whole thing is like, I've been holding people at arm's length and now I don't have to.
Yeah.
And therefore I'm going to hold them at two arm's length. So you're like, okay, great.
Yeah, it's quite boring. And we can all think of other characters. Like, I'm thinking about like Dr. House from the show House.
Oh, Jesus.
That show was insufferable.
It really, like every season, it's like, what house are we getting again this season?
Yeah.
And it's just like, if your shtick is, oh, you're a grumpy fucker, it's like, okay, but like, grumpy fuckers can still have character development. Don't hide behind like, oh, well, that's just their personality. It's like, okay, but you have a responsibility as a storyteller to tell the story of this character, and no story is interesting that just like goes like this forever. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't like those stories. And so I think that that's something that that a lot of creatives, like, they get caught up in the vibes of a character and they forget the responsibility to tell a story with the character.
Yeah. I think too, there's a little piece of it where I think sometimes when people look at fiction and even in their own lives, right? It's like, once I overcome this obstacle, everything's done. Right. And so it's like, you know, and, or once I hit this milestone, like, I don't have anything else. But the reality is, like, you make an adjustment in your life and you look around and now you see the new obstacles. Mm-hmm. You see the new milestones and goals. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same kind of thing, right? You get through this arc and you're, and ideally, even if it's a series, you should have an arc because when you have those, I don't love it when I read a book and it's like, well, it's a series, so now the arc is dangling because we only have one very long arc. It's hard to sustain and it's hard to keep an interest in a character who's going to, like, take very, very, very long to sort of shift. But you get that first arc, right? Then they need to sort of, you know, reintegrate themselves and find new things, which is also, I think, where it is nice having multiple points of view, because you can sort of pop a new character up to have the new big problem while this one is sort of going through its, like, Relics of Ruin has a new point of view character.
Oh, cool. So does my sequel. Yeah.
Right. Like, you put the drama llama up top and then let everybody work through their problems and find their new drama.
Aaron, knowing who that new character point of view is, I just love the description of drama llama.
But I do have to say that doesn't mean that a character with a series wide arc can't still be struggling with something at the end of the series that they were struggling with at the beginning. Like, you can, like, so allow me to completely geek out over one of my favorite series of all time.
We're here for
Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah. Okay?
Yep. Like, one of the greatest.
I have to insert, they just added Xena to freaking Raid Shadow Legends, which is
Are you serious?
Xena is playable in Raid Shadow Legends now. This is the end of all things. Yeah. I saw that yesterday.
This is amazing. Xena is an incredible series, and one of the most amazing things about the series is the character arcs. And there is the character of Gabrielle, who she starts the series as, like, this village girl who wants to be a writer and can't do anything. And she ends the series as basically taking over Xena's mantle. Mm-hmm. But throughout the entire series, she struggles with the question of violence, of whether or not violence is ever called for, whether or not she should participate in violence. She has a period, like, in the middle of the series where she, like, rejects all violence. And so that arc for her character, she never, like, comes to a conclusion in terms of the way that she struggles with violence, but her character still has this amazing arc as she works through that conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true to human beings. Like, if we think about, like, the big existential things that we struggled with when we were 20, we've grown beyond, but, like, some of that stuff is still with us and will probably be with us for our entire life. So it's okay to have a character who is struggling with the same thing, but you have to show movement.
Yeah.
Right. And that is where, if you don't have that, everything falls flat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a really good point. And I would like to amend what I said slightly, which is that I think that where it gets problematic is when you have an arc that is meant to last the whole series that does not sort of have the juice to go that long. Mm-hmm. And for an example, like Gabrielle and Xena, right? Those, you've got sort of like an arc for each episode. Something is happening in each episode or each group of episodes. You have an arc for a season, and then you have an arc for the whole series. And that is a good way to think about books too, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have the things that are happening that are going to be contained within the book. You have the things that are happening, which are going to be contained, you know, within the arc of the series. And if you have something that if your career goes in a way where you're going to be like, I write the Legend of Dritz for the next 35 years,
right?
Like, mazel tov, but also you're going to have to break that up into more smaller arcs, because there is still going to have to be a huge trajectory. And those are different sort of, you know, even like looking in your life, right? There are different things. There are the things that you struggle with your whole life, and there are the things that you struggle with for a season. And if the season thing becomes a life struggle, I start to get impatient with you,
Right. Yeah.
Because, because that idea of like, what is my, you know, when is violence justified? Is it ever justified? What does that mean if I'm someone who does that? That's a big question. If it's, you know, something smaller, like, should I leave my town or not? Right. Like, I want you to come to that conclusion a little, or work towards that conclusion a little faster. Cause you're right that like, there has to be forward momentum. And for a big question, that forward momentum is more like climbing a mountain. Uh-huh. And for a small question, it's like, jump the fucking speed bump already.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I completely agree. Yeah.
I just have to say, cause I Googled it. I gotta say, the key art for Xena and Raid Shadow Legends is pretty badass.
Okay, share it. Put it in the chat.
Yeah. Let me see if I can. Oh God, that's.
Yep.
Wait. Copy link image. There we go. Ha ha. Yeah. So here's badass Xena. Nothing has actually made me ever consider downloading this game. And you know what?
Yep.
I might get a play
Xena. Yes, yep. Please.
Yep. I put up a poll that I'm like, does anyone actually play this game or even know anyone who plays this game? And 90% of the results were no, I don't, and no, I don't. But that might have gone
just, like,
up now.
Quote tweet the poll and have the picture of Xena and be like,
what about now?
Counterpoint or Xena.
I kept waiting for her to show up in Fortnite, and unfortunately it just didn't happen.
Oh, that would have been great.
Well, yeah. There's still time. They're running out of literally everything else. So
I did actually
miss this show.
I did actually
hadn't thought about it in so many years, and I'm like, I miss Xena.
I recently rewatched it and it was like, it was stunning to me to realize how much it influenced me as a creative from
it's
watching
the
it.
The wildest thing.
I was just like, oh my God, this had a major influence on me. Like, it was a delightful experience to rewatch it, just be and to rediscover my origins as a writer. It was wonderful.
That is one of my wife's all-time favorite shows, to the point that I literally texted her just now and said, I just want to let you know our guest used Gabrielle from Xena as an example for character development. And she just said, that's the most fantastic thing. I love it. Okay, so this is another thing that I wanted to ask, because like, when I hear the word sequel, I usually only think of the second one, but like, is like, you're talking about the third one for both of you there, right? Is that the sequel to the second one? Is that the same beast as writing the second one?
I mean, I call it the threequel.
The threequel.
I call it the threequel because I think that like, if you have a duology or a series, like, those experiences are very different of writing a sequel and being done with the sequel versus writing a threequel or a series. Because when you have a threequel, that means that the sequel is playing a very specific, it's doing a very specific job of like bridging the start of the conflict with the conclusion of the conflict. And lots of people have talked about not liking sequels. Lots of people have talked about, oh, the sequel is the best one in the series. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of expectation of what the sequel will do, because it expands the world and the narrative and the stakes of the first one. But it also has to essentially open up what's going to happen in the third one.
Yeah.
And that, you know, puts it in this unique position where it has to be good, but it also has to set up for something better. Like, the third one has to be the best one. Right? Because it has to be the payoff. And so you can't put all of your eggs in the sequel basket.
Yeah.
Right? You have to save some shit for that third one. And so it's been an interesting balancing act. And Aaron, as someone who's done this more than me in terms of publishing, I'd be delighted to hear what you think of that.
I think my opinion is that this, previously I would have said the sequel, the first book out of the gate after the first one is the hardest, right? Because the first one is sort of the shape of a book, right? And then you're like, and now I have to pivot and start the shape of a series, especially if you wrote that first book thinking this might be the only one, right? Which was the case for me in both books, right? And then so you have to sort of like reconfigure, reset your expectations of the flow of this. Brimstone Angels was open-ended. They basically wanted me to keep writing books until they said, now stop, because we're not making books anymore. and so that was a case of like expanding in a way that was responsible, right? Because you want to keep kind of making it bigger, but eye toward the end so that you can come back in, because otherwise you end up with like, all the threads are everywhere and I could not possibly weave these back together. And for this one, I am finding that quick pivot, right? Because you want, like, because what you're saying is absolutely right. You have to pay everything off and it has to be its own exciting book. And so there is that sort of like, it needs to escalate, but then it needs to come back down and get woven back together, becomes very tricky. I find with Books of the Usurper, the other thing that's interesting as an experience for book three is the first two books are very much mystery novels. Mystery novels in an epic fantasy setting, right? And so I knew, I wrote the first one, I knew what I wanted the next book to be. And when I sold it, I was like, it's as many as you want, because that was my experience. And they're like, then it's three. And I'm like, got it. So weaving together something that is the end of the climax and end of an epic fantasy trilogy that does also contain a mystery at its core, because if this one breaks the pattern.
Yeah, you can't do that.
People are going to be like, what the hell? This doesn't feel good. This doesn't feel the same. It feels like housekeeping. Like, oh, this is sort of different. Whereas I think if they had said, oh yeah, give me another six, right? You have the nice thing about a series, if you can, because it's the same sort of thing. Like you need a mountain, not a speed bump. And so you need to be able to keep kind of escalating that while giving people satisfying growth, right? They need to like hop up the rocks as they go.
Right.
But you have time to sort of let things breathe and really look at everything and go, okay, where does this go and how does it land? Because you have all that space. And maybe you can get that space with a trilogy by just, you know, blowing your deadlines or something. Thinking really fast. But that is the thing I miss about writing a longer series, is that I think it gets it when you have that sort of like, there are more books ahead of me, assuming nobody cancels them. You have that space to sort of like let it open and kind of see which things you're going to bring back in, or kind of pull back here and go, hey, remember this thing? We're going to knot it back up. So it's a different thing. It's a sequel, but it's also a totally different element. I think your point too about like the middle book, like, and saving things for the sequel. Saving things for the sequel is such a like difficult, like calculus, because on the one hand, I've seen people do the thing where like you read their draft of their second book and you're like, this is like treading water.
Yep.
Like, why don't they do this thing? And they're like, oh, that comes in the third book. It's like something has to happen here, right? You don't want to save all the good stuff. You want to hope you have the big ideas, but you're right. You can't have the climax be in the second book, because then it's sort of like, well, what happens now? Like we just wrap up threads.
Yeah.
That's not the book.
Yeah. When you're talking there though about like the saving stuff for the third one has to be the best one. Like my brain went to a discussion I saw recently about the Across the Spider-Verse movie, which was the second one in that series, and it ends on a to be continued. And the discussion I kept seeing was like, oh, people saying like, I really love this movie, but man, that third one is gonna make or break this movie.
Yes.
And that like I've thought about like the different films at least that I've seen that done that were like, you know, the second one ends on a to be continued, The Matrix, Pirates of the Caribbean, Back to the Future and stuff. And the varying degrees of how much that's true, because like Back to the Future, I don't particularly like the third one. It's not my jam. I'm like, cowboys, cool, whatever.
No,
like
flying train one.
It was fine, but like the second one, I'm like, this is my stuff, because like we're going through alternate timelines, we're time traveling a bunch. We get to see 2015, which is still wild that we're 8 years out from that.
With no flying boards,
You know, God, I still love Robert Zemeckis lying in that documentary that like hoverboards were real, Mattel made them, but like all the parents wrote in and said they were too dangerous, so they took them off the market.
I mean, ironically enough, that's kind of what actually happened, like, some years later. Like, people kept cracking their heads off of those.
The little roller ones.
That's
yeah,
right, the roller things.
Off of the hoverboards. So, it's, yeah.
Vine was full of people just putting their heads through walls on those. But, so like, I don't know. I can't think of like a novel though that has really done that, where it's a trilogy and it's like the first one is a standalone and then two and three are like, you know, contingent on each other. They're two parts.
The freaking Lord of the Rings.
Games.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
100% ends on a cliffhanger.
I guess the reason I don't go with that was because, like, then the third one is just like, but we're going to stop all momentum on that absolutely at the beginning and not pick up on that thread till the end.
That's well-worn territory of storytelling, though, that it's kind of like we can do. The first part is, here is, here is something that we hope you like. In the second one, it's that you kind of have an understanding. I mean, the Avengers movies did it, that it's like, we all know that you're on this ride now. Mm-hmm. Now we can kind of stretch this out a little bit. I mean, that's not so strange. Although I do think something we've said out loud in the past and didn't say out loud this time is, although we joke about saving something for the sequel, sitting on your best idea, thinking that you're going to use it later is not the move. Like, you'll have other ideas. Mm-hmm. Melt people's faces now, which will make it way more likely that you'll get a chance to do it again. And even if you fall short and you're only remembered for having the best part of your book be in the middle, I'd rather be remembered for the guy that, you know, the Battle of Helm's Deep was better than the Battle of Minas Tirith than the guy that didn't get to have a good battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that's true.
Yep.
Before we do that, I went back into our emails and grabbed one piece of a listener question that I wanted to bring back up, but I do have one other question that I want to put out there, which is, you know, we've talked about like the hurdles and stuff like that, but it's like, what do you look forward to when you get to, like, you're sitting down, you're like, I'm writing the sequel? Like, what is the thing that you're like, I'm excited about this?
Wait, sorry. Could you rephrase that? I zoned out. Sorry, I'm doing so good. I'm doing so good. We're so close to the end. And
What do you look forward to when it comes to writing a sequel? What is the thing that, like, gets you excited?
I know you will be absolutely shocked to hear this, but I planned the stories out in advance.
I know you do.
I already know what's gonna happen. So to me, it's that I like paying off seeds I've planted. That's what I like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That I'm like, that, you know, Chekhov's plasma rifle that I mentioned.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
You know, that I'm like, stay
tuned. It's been
tuned.
There the whole series. It has to go off at some point.
I waited just long enough for you to forget that it was there. You know, that's what I like.
Yeah.
It's fair.
I think that too, you know, I definitely like the idea of like having something that happens in the first book or that was hinted at in the first book come to fruition, in the second book. I think that, I'm not thinking just of the sequel right now, but I'm thinking of, like, in my case, the threequel, like, things that I'm looking forward to is having these characters who we've followed for so long, like, have their final defining moment. Mm-hmm. Like, they've had definitional moments throughout the series, but, like, I want to end them each with, like, a bang of, like, the quintessential them thing happens in the third book. And so, you know, like, if you've got a character who's a hacker and she's doing more and more interesting hacking as the series goes on, like, what is the most blow your mind climax you can have for her as a hacker at the end of the series? And so, like, I like working that out and thinking about what that's going to mean. But I also like the idea of taking characters and putting them somewhere that they didn't think they would be. Where the reader didn't think they would be, and setting up like a pattern maybe, and then disrupting that pattern to sort of mess with people's expectations of what's going to happen next. And so that is definitely fun for me.
But you are.
The first thing I thought of is just coming back to the characters, you know, that you spent that time building, and just that there's something very, I don't know, that feeling of figuring out how to ship them along their arc, and but coming back to something that's familiar and also changing. I don't know. That sounds very wishy-washy, but that particular feeling is nice. That is the one thing I like about my book three struggles, is I like coming back and picking up these characters again and being like, oh yeah, yeah, you went through some shit.
Yeah, for sure.
When I had that one time where I was like, okay, I finished this one, I'm going to start thinking about ideas for a sequel, the thing that did get me excited, and this kind of plays to what Bethany was saying, it was like, I had it in my head of characters interacting who didn't get to interact in the first one. And that got me excited of like, okay, well, yeah, what would these two do if they were in, you know, a life or death situation? Like, we've seen it with these other characters, but like, these two didn't get to interact at all. And I want to see what that's going to be like. So
yeah.
Mixing things up, I think it was what was getting me excited for it. Yeah. But yeah, I wanted to bring up a question. This is from a while ago. This is from June. But this is from Carly. They said, I heard mixed messages about mentioning sequels while querying, which I plan to do later this year. After I get the first book back from beta readers, should I mention it's part of a planned trilogy or no?
I would say no.
I think again, you can say standalone with series potential. Ideally, yep, that is true. Yep. Like, don't lie if you're like, I actually cut off in the middle of a scene. They're going to know, and it's going to be what it is.
You're like, it's a standalone series potential, and it ends like The Sopranos. just right? Mid-sentence.
Right? You're like, yep. It's ambiguous. It's fine. Don't lie about it, but I mean.
I would say don't start doing the marketing for them. Right. Like, they're the one who gets to decide how they're going to market your book and whether or not it's a trilogy or a duology or a standalone. And they know the market and they're driven by market forces. Like, this is one of the hardest things about publishing, is that you can write an absolutely brilliant book and it not get placed because it doesn't meet their market needs. And so you don't want to do anything that will make them think that you don't meet their market needs. So if they're going through a period of time where they're like, you know, we need to sign some standalones. For whatever reason, we don't want trilogies right now. Like, I'm just imagining, you don't want to be the querier who's saying to them, oh, this brilliant book is meant to be a series. And then they say, oh, this is a brilliant book, but we don't want it because we're not looking for a series right now. Yeah. We don't have room for that in our publishing schedule. And so even though your book was fantastic, you put them in a position where they couldn't sign on to that vision. And so they passed on it.
I think that is a great example, because I definitely, from what I've heard, like, those situations are going to happen way more, where they're like, we just want a standalone. Then they're like, we're looking for the next great series. Like, that's
right. I mean, exactly.
Like, that's the thing. They might, you don't know. Right.
Yeah.
And so if it is something where, like, that is why we keep harping on the phrase standalone with series potential, right? Because you're telling them, I am flexible. And
I can do
that.
In sci-fi and fantasy, like, it is fairly common right now for publishers to purchase trilogies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not universal. Mm-hmm. And certainly saying that you can be versatile and you can give them more if they want it is going to be put you in a much better position than saying to them, you'll love my book, but you have to buy a trilogy for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're getting towards the end of the show here. Anyone got any last thoughts on sequels?
Sorry, go ahead,
BD. I was just gonna say, it's ultimately a good problem. Yes, it's a headache, but it means people loved it enough to want some more. So there's worse things to happen to you.
There you go.
I was going to say, it's like, you know, it can be an excruciating process, but like, it also shows that you've like arrived in a certain way, you know? And I think that it's really important. Like, this is something I'm struggling with today because like writing has been going terribly today. You like, have to find a way to remind yourself of what you love about the story and these characters and what's happening. Because otherwise I think you get caught in this slog of, well, I have to write this effing sequel and I don't like it, or things like that. It's like, no, you get to continue this story. So like, what do you need to do to get yourself to an emotional place where you can actually appreciate what you're able to do here?
Love it.
I needed to hear that. Thank you. I'm like, I know what I need to do next.
Like, I need to do it right now. My revisions are due December 1st, and I'm like convinced that it's terrible, you know? Oh. So it's definitely like a time where I need to really like buckle down into reminding myself that I love writing. And I love the story, you know?
That is, I think, one of the things, this is not about sequels, but I'm going to say it anyway. This is one of those things about publishing. I feel like there's so much about publishing that has nothing to do really with the sort of the art and the creation and the joy of writing, right? Because we do things, I mean, obviously they're entangled, right? But at the same time, right, you start to get into like, it has to be by the deadline. I have to make these people happy with it. I have to think about the numbers. I have to do these things. And this is separate from, I am creating something and I'm taking joy in the creation of the thing.
Right.
And we start to think about like the result. It's like the process, the process is important. So last year, this was like, my whole thing was like, I'm getting to a place where I am punishing myself for the thing that I do because it brings me joy. That's messed up. So I'm very there with you.
100%. Yeah.
Love it. Well, Bethany, thank you so much for joining us today and talking to us about sequels. This is a great talk. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
If people wanted to find you and what you do and your work, where could they do so?
You can find me for who knows how long on Twitter. Name Bethany Jacobs. I'm also on Instagram under Dr. Bethany Jacobs. I'm on Blue Sky under Bethany Jacobs. And you can find, you know, information about my newsletter and events and upcoming publications at my website, which is Bethany-Jacobs.com. And you can find my book in bookstores, These Burning Stars.
Heck yeah. I'm going to go do that later today. Aaron, B. Dave, where can people find you and awesome things you're working on?
You can find me on Blue Sky and Twitter at Aaron M. Evans. You can join me on twitch.tv/dungeonscrawlers every Monday at 1:30 p.m. Pacific for Concentration Check, a co-writing space. Come get some writing done with me. And then again at 6:30 p.m. Pacific on the same channel for Fearful Symmetry, the D&D game I run with a bunch of fantasy writers. And you can next week, or actually, when does this go out?
This is going out November 29th.
It was so nice to see you guys at Dragon's Den. It was such a great experience. Pick up my book, Empire of Exiles, which is out now, and pre-order Relics of Ruin. Comes out at the end of April.
Yeah.
It is I, B. Dave Walters. You can find me at B. Dave Walters, Erwar. And I'm also about to crawl back into bed is where you can find me. By the 29th, my promo will be over. But you know what? I'll leave the coupon codes live and just not tell anybody. So you can visit theundisputedacademy.com. Use code 14day50 to get 50% off 14-day writer, which is relevant to this, but also 14-day DM, 14-day player, 14-day TTRPG creator. If you'd like to know how to take your skills to a professional level, I got you. So code 14-day50, but don't tell nobody. So I'm doing it just for you guys.
Link is in the description below.
Hashtag link in bio.
You can find me on all of the dystopian social medias at The Trevor. There is an A hiding in there. Bethany, again, thank you so much for joining us today. This is an absolute great talk. I hope we get to have you on again to talk about other book stuff.
Me too. Thank you so much. This was great fun.
And thank you all out there for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, the best way to support the show is by leaving a review on your podcast service of choice and tell your friends about the show. If you have any questions, you can send those into writingaboutdragonsshit@gmail.com. And if you'd like to keep up to date on the show, you can follow us on Blue Sky @aboutdragons. But until next week, go write about some dragons and shit.